You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Africa on Fire on KBOO Radio. Africa on Fire is a Pacific Northwest news and public affairs broadcast dedicated to Africa and her people. In this hour, we celebrate the legacy and influence of Africans in Latin America. We'll hear from Mexican filmmaker Rafael Corona and local Afro-Ecuadorian expert Ethan Johnson, and a Portland drumming instructor talks about African musical influence in Cuba. Plus more international and local African news the corporate media won't divulge. I'm your host, Marianne Fry. Our guest co-host is Portland's Latina peace and media activist, Andrea Cano. Join us. Africa is on fire.
Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa.
Coming up later in this hour, local African news and events. We turn now to Africa on Fire's international African news. A new report says economic activity rose 5% in Africa during 2005 and is expected to reach 6% in 2006 and 2007. The report was issued by the African Development Bank and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The report shows the continent has made significant strides in democracy with a decline of political instability despite election time flares. The report noted better fiscal discipline, rising commodity prices, debt reduction, and low inflation. It's no surprise that oil leads the list of natural resource and raw material exports. The lack of transportation infrastructure remains a serious barrier, especially in rural areas, where daily errands like collecting water leave people with little time. There's been a 50% decline in development aid donor commitments, although debt cancellations helped in some countries, according to the report. In related news, The Nation newspaper reports that Kenya's economy grew by almost 6% last year, a performance not seen in a decade. The mobile telephone industry emerged as the second highest revenue earner after East African breweries. While Kenya witnessed one of the worst droughts in decades, agricultural production was up by almost 7%, according to the Ministry of Planning and National Development.
And now, news from Nigeria, where a federal court in Nigeria has ordered an oil giant corporation to pay more than $1 billion in compensation. The Federal High Court in Port Harcourt, Rivers State, has ordered Shell Petroleum Development Company, or the SPDC, to pay $1.5 billion to the Aja aborigines of the Bayelsa State. The SPDC was ordered to pay the Ajas the amount as compensation for the damage done to their land for nearly 50 years. According to the Vanguard newspaper in Lagos, the money is being held at the Central Bank of Nigeria, awaiting a substantial appeal.
Sub-Saharan Africa is the fastest urbanizing region in the world, but many live in poverty. According to the United Nations, about 72% of urban populations in Africa still live in slums and informal settlements. Cities in Africa contribute more than 60% of the gross domestic product, but fail to provide adequate housing and basic services. The chairman of the Senate African Affairs Subcommittee, Republican Senator Mel Martinez of Florida, said massive population shifts in Africa have raised serious policy issues for African governments. He said the rapid rate of urbanization had serious economic, social, and health implications, adding that social disorder simmers in this region because of overcrowding and economic despair. In 1994, the urban population in Africa was approximately 172 million. By 2004, it had grown to 264 million, this according to the East African Standard.
Europe has pledged to fund girl-centered schools in Egypt. The European Union is to fund 200 new girl-friendly schools countrywide to work toward greater inclusion of females in education. The EU will work in cooperation with the National Council for Childhood and Motherhood, who have a proven model, have proven their model with 500 such schools. Most existing girl-friendly schools are located in Upper Egypt, where school attendance rates, particularly among girls, are lowest. While girl-friendly schools cater both to both girls and boys, their curriculum and administration are specifically designed to encourage girls, often burdened with traditional household responsibilities, to attend. The model also focuses on non-traditional modes of learning. According to the 2005 Human Development Report for Egypt, while 35% of the national population cannot read or write, 45% of girls and women over the age of 15 are illiterate.
Child mortality rates are rising in West Africa. UNICEF reports that every fifth child born in sub-Saharan Africa will die before they reach 5 years old. Children in Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Niger, and Sierra Leone born in 2004 are less likely to live than those born in 1990. One of the biggest causes of child death is malnutrition. The problem is so out of hand in many West African countries that very few are likely to meet the UN's goal of cutting world hunger in half by 2015. The UN uses the percentage of children under five who are underweight as its benchmark for change in hunger. Of those children who do survive, malnutrition can have lasting implications and has been linked to behavioral and development problems.
In Afro-Latino news, Uganda recently joined other African, Latin, and Asian countries in opposing the introduction of agricultural terminator seeds. Terminator seeds are genetically altered, then a gene that destroys the ability to germinate and produce subsequent generations is inserted. The seed is seen as an endangerment to soil and livelihoods of smallholder farmers. Ugandan Environmental Minister Jeje Odong spoke during one of the largest global meetings about biological diversity held 4 weeks ago in Brazil. Odong told the New Vision in Kampala that lobby groups from Africa, Asia, and Latin America overwhelmingly attacked the Terminator technology.
Johannesburg's Business in Africa newspaper reports that Ghana is to receive a major agricultural boost. The large Brazilian agricultural research institution, Embrapa, has selected Ghana as its African regional base. The company is to partner with Ghana and other African countries in priority areas such as food security, energy production, and agribusiness. Ghana is to benefit from the scientific and technical know-how which has transformed Brazil into one of the world's major agricultural nations. The move is also to help solidify ties between Brazil and Africa. In other African and Brazil news, Africa's largest media group has acquired part of a Brazilian company for $422 million. The South African media giant Naspers bought 30% of Brazil's Abril Group. According to Joburg's Business Day paper, Naspers has been the best performing stock on the Bloomberg World Media Index. Brazil and Kenya have announced plans to pressure the upcoming World Health Assembly in Geneva, Switzerland, for more funds to combat neglected diseases, including HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And Africa Day was commemorated last week in Brazil. Those from Angola, Cape Verde, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau celebrated the day with lectures and cultural activities. The festivities continue through June, according to the Angola Press Agency.
South Africa stands to greatly benefit from a number of technological advancements Cuba has made. Last month, Cuba and South Africa finalized agreements on information and communication technologies. The South Africa-Cuba ICT agreement establishes a joint committee that will identify communications projects that both countries can implement. At the same time, an agreement was signed between the South African Broadcasting Corporation and the Cuban Institution for Radio and Television, which is expected to result in collaborative programs. This according to VOA News. And 30-year-old diplomatic ties between Ethiopia and Cuba are expected to be extended between the two countries. Ethiopia's Speaker of the House of the Federation, Dagifa Buya, said many Ethiopians have been educated in Cuba, further developing the East African country. The Ethiopian Herald reports that Cuba now wants to broaden cooperative efforts with Ethiopia in several areas, including water, agriculture, and education.
You've been listening to International African News on Africa on Fire. I'm Marianne Fry with Andrea Cano. Tonight, we celebrate the rich influence of Africans in Latin America. We begin by hearing from Mexican filmmaker Rafael Corona. His films celebrate the legacy of Africans in Mexico. Africans living in Latin America is a little researched area. We recently spoke with Rafael Ribola Corona, a Mexican filmmaker visiting Portland for the Cascade Festival of African Films. His 2001 film, Forgotten Root, chronicles the history of Afro-Mexicans during the 15th to 18th centuries. His third film, A Work in Progress, portrays African spirituality in Mexico. Welcome to Africa on Fire, Mr. Corona.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yes, our pleasure. During the 15th through the 18th centuries, the number of Africans of Mexican descent greatly outnumbered the Spanish. Do you know what the population of Afro-Mexicans is today?
Well, they are very mixed, mm-hmm. but we can find a lot of them very distinctively in the Gulf, in the coast of the Gulf of Mexico, and in the Pacific coast as well. At the south, if everybody knows where Acapulco is. Mm-hmm. Well, all the that region that it's in that it's in the south of Acapulco. If you go there, you can see it's the African phenotype. It's very present.
Do most of the Mexicans of African descent live in this region of Mexico?
Well, I suppose, I guess that it's like that. But the Africans were in all the country. They were in the north. They were working in the mines. And in all the Pacific coast, even in Mexico City, if you pay attention and if you have and if you know how to recognize, you're going to find a lot of people that have African ancestors. Sometimes I ask the people in the street, "Hey, where are you from?" "I'm from Michoacán. I'm from Puebla, etc." "And do you know which are your ancestors and all that?" And they don't even know nothing about it. They are very Mexican, you know,
mm-hmm.
but it's something that has been that is lost in history. And what happens is that in the official history of Mexico, they mention only two lines in the books about the African presence in Mexico. No? So I think it's something that has not been recognized. There's no acknowledgement to the work and to the role that the Africans played in the building of Mexican country.
Why do you think that is, Mr. Corona?
There are several reasons. I think there's a quota of racism in that thing. Also, it's not a very convenient subject to touch in terms of the political situation of Mexico. After the Mexican Revolution, the ideology of the revolutionary people, they wanted to build a notion of Mexico that we are only a nation that was a mix between Spanish and Indian people. When we speak about Spanish, it's very different if you are speaking about Spanish from Galicia or from Andalusia. And there are many Indians, many groups of Indians in Mexico. So it's not only the Spanish and the Aztecs. No? And they wanted to build a notion of a very homogeneous nation, a very strong nation and all that. And Mexico, it has not been like that. And I think that the Indians are something like a symbol of Mexico. They are the flag of a lot of political struggles and things like that. There are thousands of titles of films and books about the Indians, but and the African presence has been relegated, you say in English?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah. I was looking at your resume, and I was struck by the fact that you had a degree in chemical engineering, and then you switched to get an additional degree in filmmaking. Why is it important for you to tell the story of Africans in Mexico?
I think it's very important because it has not been done. There are only 6 or 7 Mexican productions about this subject, and I have been working in 4 of them. I think it's very important because if we start to recognize that presence, another presence that have contributed in a very important way to build Mexico, we are making grow a tolerance feeling in the country. And I think that the diversity in Mexico is our main asset in the country, and it's our main richness. So we have to revalorate all these things.
Your film, Forgotten Root, addresses the legacy of Africans brought to Mexico as slaves. Where did the Africans come from in Africa?
I understand that they came from West Africa, several countries. They were Bantus, and they came from Angola, from several countries in the West African coast.
Can you explain to us, Mr. Corona, what life was like for Africans in Mexico during the 15th through 18th centuries?
House life? Mm-hmm. It was very different. Well, there were a lot of slaves, but there were a lot of Africans that they had another kind of roles in Mexican society at that time. For example, in the Costa Chica of Guerrero and Oaxaca, the Spaniards took Africans to manage the cattle and all that. They were cowboys. The Indians didn't know how to do it. And almost all the Indian groups that were living at that part of Mexico, they were extincted because of the diseases that Europeans and Africans brought to the continent, and because they didn't treat them very well, you know. So they had to take some Africans there, and they were ruling the work. They were not slaves. And a lot of runaway African people, they went to the Pacific coast because of that. Instead of that, in the coast of the Gulf of Mexico, the slavery was more strong.
Mm-hmm.
And then even in Mexico City, in the state of Morelos and Puebla, they work as slaves in the haciendas and all that. It depends. And they were working in the mines also, but there were also African landlords that had Indians to their service and all that. So it's a very complex situation. The slavery trading finished in Mexico at the 17th century, because it has no case already, because it was not business. There was a lot of people to work, so they stopped bringing slaves to Mexico.
We're speaking with Rafael Reboller Corona, a Mexican filmmaker in Portland recently for the Cascade Festival of African Films. Mr. Corona, what African cultural and other traditions were maintained in Mexico?
I think it's very mixed with the other cultures, with the Indian cultures and with the European cultures. For example, in all the Mexican music, the researchers have found a lot of African influence in Mexican music. One of the most stereotypically Mexican music is El Son de la Negra, for example, que dice a mariachi son, and La Bamba from Veracruz.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the most famous, the more touristic, I can say. But we can find in all Mexican music a lot of African influence. And in the dances and in the Costa Chica of Guerrero and Oaxaca, and all the dances and the festivities, it's very easy to see that. And some of the believings also. I'm working right now, for example, in another documentary that I'm trying to get some funds to finish it. they're all believing about that some people are animals at the same time.
Animals, you say?
Yes, animals. Mm-hmm. This is a very general believing in Mexico and even in Latin America. I think in everywhere, no? The links between the human beings and the animals, it's present in all cultures in the world. But the form that it has in the Costa Chica of Guerrero and Oaxaca, it has a very African component. Tono, it's a word that comes from the Nahuatl language. But in the Costa Chica, they say that a tono, it's a man that it's an animal at the same time. So it's a spiritual identity that results in a dual existence, human and animal. And the Nahualismo, it's all the phenomena. In fact, there's an American researcher, Iván Sertima, that he sustains that el Nahual, it's a word that comes from Africa. Well, he tries to prove that, and it's very interesting what he says. But the Nahualismo is a transformation into an animal that does not invalidate the human nature hidden under another identity.
It sounds very powerful.
Yeah.
What is the general quality of life for Afro-Mexicans in Mexico today?
Well, I think they live in a very hard conditions. They are farmers, how do you say, campesinos, or in English, the people that works in the country and live in the rural regions. I think that the conditions for all the people that lives in the country, it's they are very hard. And I think they work in the coast and the shores. They have fish and they are fishers and all that. They arrange more or less to survive, no? But I think their conditions are very hard. They have a lot of economical problems. There's a violence problem in all that region. And it's a very complex to say. I don't know if it's because they can say I thought in all.
Yeah. And just earlier back that Africans haven't had to hold until recently about their in Mexico. What do you foresee changing
right now?
Uh-huh.
And we have two regions in Veracruz in the Gulf of Mexico and Guerrero and Oaxaca in the Pacific where we have more movement about that. And what I have noticed is that in the Pacific Coast, there are several persons that have been working in that issue in some little towns. In El Ciruelo, it's a little town in Oaxaca, in Cuajinicuilapa, in Guerrero, in Morelos, that is in Oaxaca. There have been some, a kind of intellectual people that they are from the region and they are working in that. And they are trying to recover all that part of the hidden history. There's a very interesting case with a Trinitarian priest, a man from Trinidad and Tobago, that his name is Jemot. He has been working for 17 years in El Ciruelo, and he has a library, he has a school, and all that. And he is paying a lot of attention to that subject. In Cuajinicuilapa, there are a group, they have a museum. They have built a Museo de Culturas Afromestizas. They develop certain activities and all that. So I think everybody's starting to talk about we are Negros and we are very proud of it and all that. You know, I think that's changing between the population.
That's great news. Thank you, Rafael Riboler Corona, for speaking with us on Africa on Fire.
Thank you very much.
Andrea, several years ago, you introduced me to the fact that up to 10% of Mexicans are of African descent. That was surprising to me at the time, and in fact surprising to a lot of local African immigrants I spoke with. Where did these statistics come from?
Well, it was something that was cited to me, and I really can't give you the actual statistical resource or source of that. That was about 20 years ago. I wasn't really surprised, and particularly once I started to travel through Mexico and actually live there, you get to see the essentially not quite the melting pot elements of Mexico, but you know that there's a lot more mobility of people from one culture to the other. One of the things that was also very important, and I'm so glad that Rafael has done this study, because it really is, as he said, it has only earned about two lines in history books, but we really need to look and delineate the contributions of the different African cultures that came to reside and flourish in parts of Mexico. And I would even say that even Guerrero, if you look at number of the population, I would even think that we would consider there were Pacific Islanders that came over to Mexico and settled. So I think, you know, there's still many, many untold stories of who arrived where and who is still there.
In South America, black Venezuelans also make up about 10% of that country's population. Colombia's blacks comprise over one-fifth of their country's citizens. At 70%, Afro-Ecuadorians make up the majority of the northwest coastal region in the province of Esmeraldas. They also live in the coastal city of Guayaquil. Overall, Afro-Ecuadorians account for 5 to 10% of the Ecuadorian population. Africa on Fire's Judy Feistel recently spoke with a Portland State University Black Studies professor about Africans in this Republic of the Equator.
Dr. Ethan Johnson is assistant professor in the Black Studies Department at Portland State University. He lived in Ecuador while doing his research on the Afro-Latino experience there.
In the United States, what has happened as a result of race and our history, which is different than Latin American history, and how some scholars think about it, is that race has come out of the box, you know, the genie has come out of the box, and everybody knows about it. And so for black people, it has meant that we're able to understand that discrimination is a real aspect of our lives. In Latin America, that hasn't happened, and that's primarily happened because there's always been this space for this middle group, people who are identifiably racially mixed. What that means is that there's this place, this middle place that exists in Latin America where you can call yourself a mulatto, you can call yourself a mestizo, or you can call yourself the color of wheat or the color of cinnamon, has not made it possible for black people to have a movement as they have in the United States where we can claim blackness as a positive thing, a thing to struggle for, a thing to organize around politically and demand equality. Where in Latin America, there's always been these people who have been able to move out of blackness, which limits, inhibits any possibility for struggle through race. That, I would argue, is changing right now throughout Latin America. Brazil, recently, for the first time, has started a affirmative action programs. In Ecuador, in Colombia, in Venezuela, black people are demanding that they are represented politically, that they have rights to land, that the educational system represent them in terms of their contributions to the political and economic development of their countries. And a lot of that, you know, arguably is related to the processes that have happened in the United States. People have learned about this. But at the same time, another important aspect to understand about this is, particularly in Colombia, Venezuela, and Ecuador, is that there's large indigenous populations there. And these indigenous populations have been very active, particularly over the last 25 years, and in really pushing for their land rights, for their political rights, their economic rights in these countries. And black people have been able to build, you know, much like the women's white rights movement in the United States built off, was able to build off the anti-slavery movements, and the black people are building off the civil rights movements of indigenous people, particularly in the Andean regions of Latin America. So there's a number of reasons why black people are more recently becoming active. And I would point to, particularly in the Andean regions of Latin America, one of the things that I argue is that indigenous people have been given more of a legitimate space within the government throughout the colonial and republican histories of those governments. And so because of that, that they've been recognized officially as part of what makes up those countries, who is a citizen, indigenous people have been able to build off that and create political movements where black people have never been recognized. You can go to the histories of these countries, and if you were to read them, it would be almost like black people don't exist. But of course, when you go to those countries, they're everywhere. So in real ways, black people have been denied a legitimate space in those countries. Because of those reasons, their possibilities for struggle around issues of race again are inhibited. And Brazil and Cuba are different monsters, if you will, in terms, because those countries have not had the same indigenous experiences. And also the populations there in Cuba and Brazil are much larger than in the Andean regions. Again, you know, in Brazil, it's estimated that close to 50% of the people there are of African ancestry. And I think in very real ways that the black movement in Brazil and Cuba is much more indigenous among themselves, and it's not related to so much as what is happening in the United States. I do find really interesting about Ecuador, and particularly about the area that I studied in, Esmeraldas, Ecuador, is that it has the reputation, the history of having one of the longest quilombos that ever existed in Latin America. And by quilombo, I mean, I always have a hard time saying this, but it's because it's contradictory, but it was a free slave state. It was where people, slaves, escaped to and lived separate. Apart from the colonial government, and approximately from 1600 to 1700, a period of 100 years, in the region of Esmeraldas, people lived freely without the pressures and the oppression of the colonial government. What's important about this, particularly in the history of Ecuador and black people there, is that people in this region can claim that they never experienced slavery, right? That they were never slaves. And often what the black people there do is differentiate themselves from other black people who did experience slavery. And so they claim this, and I would argue that it's a myth that they did experience slavery, because they were brought there as slaves, they were brought on boats, and they did experience slavery, and they escaped slavery. In some of the readings that I've done, there's good proof that black people were then re-enslaved in the area, not necessarily the same black people, but black people were brought there again to be slaves, primarily because there was lots of gold found in the region, and in order to get that gold out, the colonial governments brought slaves in. But again, because of these free slave societies that were living there, it was very difficult to maintain these people to be slaves, because these other slaves saw that there was free people there and they ran away. So there's this existence there of rebellion, of freedom, and it's very important to the black people there. But at the same time, what I find really contradictory is that at the same time where there's this really powerful myth of, in reality, of freedom and rebellion exists among all black people who were brought here to the Americas from the United States all the way into Argentina, at the same time, they are dealing with a very powerful system of racism, right, that delegitimates them, that doesn't include them, that asks them to be citizens of this country without acknowledgement of their race and their racial experience. That's asking a lot, because they are constantly reminded that they are black people. And particularly, when you watch TV, when you look at what people use as advertisements, from Coca-Cola to, you know, your local ice cream store, you find really essentialized negative characterizations of black people. It goes from music and just from the ways popularly that people make sense of inequality. So while there's this really powerful existence of rebellion and freedom there, at the same time, people are dealing with the other side of this really oppressive racial system. What's important for me is that as I identify myself as a black person living in the United States, and I often, we are not taught as people, and white people too, are not taught that black people make up a huge proportion of what is south of us, through Mexico, through all of Central America, through almost every country of South America and the Caribbean. Black people are a very present part of those nations. And I think that we often forget that blackness is a very diverse thing. And as a people, we need to be more aware of this. We need to try to extend ourselves to those places, to not confine our idea of what makes up a black person. And that's what it's meant for me.
De tu man, alan durum 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 da, alan durum 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 da.
Dr. Ethan Johnson from PSU is speaking about the Afro-Latino experience in Ecuador. This is Judy Fiestel for Africa on Fire.
Ethan Johnson spoke about the emerging political and social rights of Afro-Latins. Africans and Latins have enjoyed long-standing relations. In the early 1960s, revolutionary Che Guevara left Cuba and traveled to several African countries. In 1965, he trained Congolese rebels after the assassination of Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. Born in Argentina, Guevara formed the Organization of Solidarity of the Peoples of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, or the Tricontinental Conference. In 1975, 250,000 Cuban soldiers traveled to Angola to help citizens fight for their independence, and several Cubans died in 1978 protecting Ethiopia during the Somali invasion. Cuban President Fidel Castro was an invited guest at Nelson Mandela's 1994 South African presidential inauguration. Embracing Fidel at the event, Mandela acknowledged South Africa's debt to Cuba.
Certainly, the South Africa relations with Latin America continue to expand. Within days of being elected as Bolivia's president, Evo Morales flew to South Africa this last January to meet with officials. As Bolivia's first indigenous president, Morales said of the two countries' common discrimination, "The struggle of our South African brothers is the same as the struggle of our people." In March of this year, South African President Thabo Mbeki was in Chile to attend the inauguration of that country's first female president, Michelle Bachelet. Mbeki said the stance Chile had taken to restructure global governance and respond more effectively to challenges was also of prime importance to Africa. According to the BUA News, while in Chile, Mbeki also engaged in discussions with other key players in Latin America. And, according to Berkeley's Daily Planet, Hugo Chavez calls himself Venezuela's first African president. One of his parents was a Asambo, or African indigenous.
Time now for Africa on Fire's local and regional news. Reports recently released by the Portland Police Bureau indicate that persons of African descent are stopped by police more than other ethnic groups. While blacks make up roughly 6% of the Portland population, they were stopped in 13% of all traffic cases in 2004 and 2005. Community forums are being held in partnership with the Portland Police to address these concerns. A June 8th forum will be held in the North Precinct area, and the June 15th meeting will be held in the Northeast Precinct area. For more information on meeting venues and statistics, visit portlandonline.com/mayor. The Center for Intercultural Organizing presents another series of Refugee and Immigrant Solidarity Education, or RISE, workshops. This four-week course, which educates participants on becoming allies for immigrant and refugee rights, begins this Saturday, June the 3rd. Register online at interculturalorganizing.org.
The Day of the African Child is routinely celebrated in Africa, but virtually unknown in the United States. This year, Portland celebrates that day on June 17th. The community gathering will honor the African child, past, present. It's on Saturday, June 17th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the World Forestry Center in Washington Park, 4033 Southwest Canyon Road in Portland. And for information, call 503-228-1367 or visit worldforestry.org.
Join an effort to strengthen united voices against hate and violence. The 2006 Oregon Hate Crimes Conference will present information on how to prevent and respond to bias, as well as contribute to a conscious community vision. The conference will be held June 21st through the 23rd at Portland Community College, Cascade Campus in North Portland. Fee is $250. For more information, visit oregonstate.edu or call 541-737-6443.
We're celebrating Africans in Latin America this hour. Portland State is offering a Caribbean Festivals class this summer. The course begins June 26th and will explore festivals in a variety of contexts. Students will also have the opportunity to help with the local July 29th Caribbean Festival. Contact instructor Carrie Hill at hillk@pdx.edu for more information.
This is Cole. This summer's Wednesday Oregon Zoo concert features predominantly African music. Amadou and Mariam from West Africa are featured on June 21st. Senegalese Baba Mall performs at the June 28th concert. And on July 5th, Kekele from the Congo will entertain zoo-goers. Shows start at 7 p.m. at the Oregon Zoo, 4001 Southwest Canyon Road in Portland. Tickets are $9.50 general admission and are available at the zoo after 4 p.m. on the day of the show. For a full summer concert of other African and Caribbean shows or to order tickets online, visit oregonzoo.org/concerts.
Immerse your child in African cultural arts with an African arts program. Homowo represents their annual African Arts Summer Camp for children up to 12 years of age. Children will experience many artistic forms found in daily African life, including drawing and drumming. The Portland camps are slated for July 10th through the 14th at the Children's Museum and July 17th through the 21st at Friendly House Community Center, both in Portland. Call 503-288-3025 for costs and more information.
Learn samba dance, including African-influenced reggae style. Pauline Serino teaches Saturday classes at the Ankeny Street Studios at Southeast 9th and Ankeny. Call 503-493-4103 for more details. And check out Seattle's summer African events at ibike.org/Africa Matters. This site is generated by our sister component at Washington State Africa Network. Send your African-related events and news to us at africaonfire@yahoo.com. At the beginning of the hour, we heard filmmaker Rafael Corona talk about the prominent influence of African music in Mexico. Afro-Latins, many who are descendants of African slaves, have kept their traditions and culture alive, especially through music. Afro-Ecuadorians are known for a distinctive type of marimba music. Several of Colombia's musical genres, such as cumbia, have African origins. Contributor Kirsten Flagg recently spoke with a Portland drumming instructor about Africa's influence on Cuban music.
Tempo. Instead of don't relax on it, stay right on top of the beat. Okay.
Fatone Niles has been teaching West African and Afro-Cuban drumming to classes just like this at Rhythm Traders on Northeast Broadway for 10 years. This last Saturday, he shared a little of his knowledge and love of percussion with Africa on Fire.
Anytime you meld cultures for centuries, the music that comes out of that, the fusion, so to speak, of different techniques, different colors, different textures, different rhythms, and when you put all those things together, it creates something that's never been done before. The slaves brought from West Africa and Central Africa over the years into the island that's now known as Cuba, mixing with European influences of the Spaniards and other European cultures, is what gives the music from Cuba that flavor, the Afro-Cuban flavor. Okay, and the European influence from Spain largely came from, especially with the singing, some of the singing mainly came out of the influence from the Moors when they occupied Spain, okay, and the use of certain verses in like 10-line format, okay. So we have that mixing in with a lot of the traditional rhythms from different regions in Africa, because you had all these slaves coming from all these different cultures all being lumped together and having to work together. Well, there's naturally an exchange between each individual from their home country. So you have this big melting pot of all these different rhythms. Combine that with some of the melodic influences from Spain and other countries in Europe, and you get what's now Afro-Cuban music, which is this really, really beautiful blend of musicianship and musicians. One of the main rhythms in Afro-Cuban music is a rhythm and a name of an instrument called clave. Sometimes you'll hear it played slightly differently. Two different forms. There's rumba clave and song clave. Some people call it the Bo Diddley beat.
Okay.
That rhythm has been used a lot in modern day rock and roll after listening to people who came in from Cuba or listening to the music of Cuba.
Can you do it again? Can you show me the difference between the rumba and the song?
Sure. Rumba.
Ultima Rumba, as arranged by Ignacio Piñerillo.
African continent, you have approximately 1,500 different languages and 850 different tribal groups. Not everybody is going to play music the same. Okay, you'll find some correlations between tribal groups because of proximity, but from my experience, it's difficult to find exact rhythms from West Africa as you're going to find in Cuba or Dominican Republic or Haiti, nor does each rhythm relate directly to another. Rumba is a school of rhythms. Okay, there's rumba wawanko, rumba yambu, rumba colombia, and some people still play a rhythm called rumba iesa, and they all have different meanings and such, and are played for different reasons. Like rumba wawanko is kind of the party rhythm. The daily newspaper, so to speak. You know, at the end of the day, people get together and have rumbas all the time, all over. I mean, if you listen carefully, you'll probably hear one going on now. some of the other rhythms are more religious in scope, like the religion of Santeria. And there's a different set of instruments that are played, bata. And within those rhythms, it's very likened to church, where each rhythm has associated with a principal deity. Okay, and depending on what needs to be done or what prayers are being offered up, those rhythms will be played to those particular quote-unquote saints or deities.
This particular rhythm is called the Bata Salute, or Tui Tui, for Shango, the owner of the Bata drums, or the deity of the Bata drums. It's performed by Miguel Santa Cruz, Gustavo Diaz, and Juan Gonzalez.
This music kind of speaks to the core of humanity, I think. Not that other forms of music don't, but because I think of the cultural basis and the rich cultural basis that this music comes from, it just gets in there.
Kirsten Flagg speaking with Katone Lyles. Lyles teaches drumming every Saturday at Rhythm Traders in Northeast Portland. I'm Marianne Fry with tonight's guest co-host, Andrea Cano. Andrea, you were born to parents of Spanish and Mexican heritage. You've been a liaison with local African groups and even have taught Kenyan cooking. In fact, we made a sweet potato dish together.
That was actually from Kenya, and I think that's one of my impulses to do kind of the bridging, the cultural bridging. And I was sitting in Nairobi and actually came across folks roasting corn on the corners there in Nairobi. And I thought to myself, you know, corn came from this part of the world. And in a sense, my kind of ancestors, the Aztecs and, you know, others really cultivated corn. So it got from this place to Nairobi. And then, of course, the other part was looking at one of the national dishes of Kenya, which is Irio, which has mashed potatoes, and, you know, potatoes came from this continent, too. So there's been a great cross-referencing of fruits and vegetables that have linked us, and that started my kind of investigation of how we are clearly connected.
Okay. And you were a board member of Oregon Africa Village, the previous print incarnation of this program. Why is it important for you, a Latina woman, to work on issues relating to Africa?
Because I think that we have very much a common threads, or clearly more threads in the tapestry of our culture and our histories. It's clear that, you know, we belong, most of us have come from below the equator, and there are particularities in our cultures that really connect us. I lived in Ecuador, and I also lived in Mexico, and I traveled throughout Latin America and the Spanish-speaking Caribbean, and began to see, you know, the very distinct cultures. And as Dr. Johnson said, you know, you don't read about these people in your history books. You don't know until you actually go and experience it. And I remember being in the northern coast of Ecuador, and actually it was a capsized slave ship that the slaves freed themselves and established their communities there in Esmeraldas, which was really a fabulous story. And actually they had one of their first indigenous, or I should say minority, community elected officials way back in, I think it was the 1800s. It was an amazing story that these folks could have their own representation. And Muisne and Atacamas, I mean, it's you go there and it's just a real sense of reception by the people. And I like to think that we really try to look at those similarities instead of the distinctions that we have among the human family. There's also a lot of justice issues that we need to look at. One of the challenges I think Johnson started to hit on a little bit is, how does one identify themselves? the categories. I mean, here in the United States, you're kind of, you know, in the census, you knock off of either you're Hispanic or you're African-American or Asian. Well, we know that within each category, there's just gradients and gradients and gradients of how we identify ourselves. And that's even more difficult in Latin America. I was there in 1992 when the whole world was looking at this hemisphere to look at the 500th anniversary of what we call the colonial start of this hemisphere. And essentially that kind of opened it up for the African Latino communities in Latin America to get to that aha moment. Now it's time to bring our stories and our souls to the light of day so that people understand who we are, what we have been, who we are now, and how we will continue to be part of our communities in the tomorrows. We've also seen a number of non-governmental organizations helping and accompanying communities, not doing it for them, but doing it with them. And I think that's the greatest strength of many of the communities that have surfaced to really begin to perceive and to work for their own human rights, their own land rights, the kinds of public services that they deserve in terms of education and shelter and jobs, the kind of political representation that is warranted in what we consider participatory democracies in these countries of Latin America.
Mm. You're involved in local media efforts, Andrea, including the Oregon Alliance to Reform Media. What needs to change about news coverage that we hear from Africa and Latin America?
Well, I think we should be able to hear a story once in a while. Because maybe our news staffs don't speak Spanish, they have very little interest in gathering information from Latin America and clearly from Africa. I think the Portland media has kind of an isolationist stance and aren't particularly open to bringing in more information from more international news. I want to remind people that this year, every television station in the state of Oregon has to reapply for their license to broadcast. So this is the one time in 8 years, folks, that we have an opportunity to monitor the news and programming on every television station and to assess whether they are giving the kind of information that we need. And if not, we can start to file informal objections and petitions to deny to the Federal Communications Commission. So it really is up to us to really explain to the stations, this is the list of types of information that we need. We can't just kind of think and think that they're going to do it. I think we as consumers of news really need to lay it out in terms of what our community information needs are to these stations. So I think I would trust that this would happen from a variety of people. Are very interested in Africa. I think if anything, well, there are a lot of folks in the Portland region who traveled, who lived, who have worked in the African country diaspora in Latin America, as well as the African and Latino resident here in this region.
Okay. And we've talked about solidarity ventures between African and Latin American countries this hour. What other news do you have in this area and hopes for the future of this?
Well, there continues to be major congresses in Latin America that really lifts the themes from the Afro-Latino community. I think organizations like the World Social Forum continue to highlight the particularities that we need to look at. And I'm really hopeful that we will continue to make those bridges. We are globalized and mass-mediated, and we should be able to be very assertive to those things.
Andrea Cano, thank you for your great community work, including in the African community. Our guests for this program are Rafael Ribolder Corona, Dr. Ethan Johnson, and Katon Lyles. Appreciation to Mary Holmes, Michael Dimbro, Bobby Carey, Patrick Engstrom Poor, Elizabeth Atley, Alfredo Feliciana, and Eric Zacharias. Join us here at Africa on Fire every first Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m. Our email address is africaonfire@yahoo.com. Tonight's producer is Kirsten Flagg. Lead producer is Judy Feastel. Kirk Vandeveer is engineer. Theme song was produced by six blind Liberian men who make up Vancouver's African Gospel a cappella. Elder consultants are Grace Couto and Bosco Conte. For Africa on Fire, I'm host and founder Marion Fry. Are you connected to the great continent of light? Africa is on fire.
Africa is on fire.
Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa, yeah, is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.